So Ruth chapter 4, the entire chapter. It's not very often I can stand up here and start and not have to do a 5 to 10 minute review of what we've learned and where we're at. And honestly, I didn't even expect to be up here. I had a twist John's arm to do last Sunday, and then he sent me a text that says, the 25th still on? I almost fell over in my chair. Dumb course, it's still good. That offer still stands. So I'm actually very excited because last week we left it at a cliffhanger. Last week we left with Ruth being sent back home to Naomi with a great present and Boaz heading out to make a plan that he has formulated go into full force action. And that's where we left it. Today I consider this a multi-generational decisions. What we're going to see today are multi-generational decisions that are going to be made. Decisions. We are faced with decisions every day of our lives. Decisions we make can have a lasting impact for generations to come. And this does not mean that we see or even think that they will. But God sovereignly uses our daily and even seemingly our mindless decisions for his plans and for his glory. Today in Ruth chapter 4, we're going to see how the decisions of two men were used in a multi-generational blessing. How these men would have not known that their decisions were going to be used by God in such a way. And I hope that as we pursue this text, we will see that if we make wise, godly decisions, hard as they may be to follow, that God will use them for his plan and for his glory. Likewise, if we make foolish, sinful decisions, God will also use them for his plan and for his glory. David made wise, godly decisions. God used them for his plans. For his glory. Yet Pharaoh made ungodly, sinful decisions, yet God used them for his plans and for his glory. So today I implore you that as we learn from the godly decisions that are made, that we would take this to heart and be remembered by godly decisions, such as David was remembered, not how Pharaoh was remembered. Just like last week, we are going to start into the text. We're going to read portions of it, and then we're going to move through. For those of you who do not know the book of Ruth that well, some of this will be a surprise to you. For those of you who know it well, you know what's coming. And for everyone in between, you're in between. So we're going to start by reading the first 8 verses of Ruth chapter 4. Now Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there. And behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, turn aside, friend, sit down here. And he turned aside, sat down, and he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit down here. Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel from the country, selling the parcel land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of these sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. And if you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one besides you to redeem it, and I come after you. And he said, I will redeem it. Then Boaz said, the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. Then the Redeemer said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it. Now this was a custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging to confirm a transaction. The one drew off his sandal, gave it to the other. And this was a manner of attesting in Israel. So the Redeemer said to Boaz, buy it for yourself. He drew off his sandal. So we're going to stop reading for this moment. First, I want us to look at Boaz. Boaz has a very defining statement here that we cannot just glance over. Now, Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there. Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there. Boaz did not go and seek this other redeemer out. He did not send a message to this redeemer. He did not send a Twitter feed, an email, all of which, of course, he didn't have. No, Boaz sat and he waited. Waiting can be one of the hardest things that can ever be done. Just sit and wait. No texting, no playing on your phone, nothing, just sitting and waiting. Now, let's not forget that Boaz has had next to no sleep. He was rudely awoken at midnight to find someone at his feet. From there, he conversed with Ruth, had her stay there till just before morning. His sleep would have been extremely sparse, if at all. Next, he gets up with everyone at the crack of dawn, gives Ruth a great present, sends her on her way, instructing everyone not to breathe a word of what happened. Then he heads to the gate to sit and wait. Now, I don't know about you, but I would have a hard time just sitting and waiting, especially after a night like that. I would not want to keep my eyes open. Just a few winks, just a cat nap. But Boaz diligently keeps watch for this other redeemer that he spoke of. Remember, there is no Starbucks. There is no Tim Hortons on every corner where he can get an extra large coffee with a double shot of espresso to keep his eyelids awake. Boaz is literally self-disciplined to stay awake. He did not have any of the modern luxuries that we have today. Boaz's sheer determination and years of self-discipline had prepared him for this time. He worked among the laborers, and he did not indulge in the comforts of life to an extreme. He kept himself vigilant and on alert. And now that has paid off, because now he has a plan, and he is now determined to execute this plan. And I love how it says here, "And behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken of came by." So Boaz is sitting, waiting, watching. Now, why did he come by? Because that gate's the main way in and out. So he knew he's going to pass by there at some point. He sees this guy. The man comes by, the one that Boaz has been waiting for. Now picture this. Boaz is sitting there, plan in hand, so to speak, ready. And this guy comes through the gate, or going to go out through the gate. Boaz calls him over and then grabs 10 elders of the city. This other redeemer has literally no clue what's going on at this moment. Okay? He has zero understanding. This guy's going about his business. He knows there's going to be some kind of business deal here, but there's no red flags. He's like, "All right, Boaz wants to talk to me," and he pulls over 10 elders. Now, just for your information, because there's been a lot of studying, a lot of reading commentaries on all the ins and outs of this stuff. Normal business transactions, the lower ones, took 2 to 3 witnesses. So if it was like, hey, dude, come over here, let's do a small business deal, they would get 2 or 3 witnesses to come. But when he gets 10 witnesses to come of the elders of the city, immediately this guy knows there's a major business transaction that's going to transpire here. There's either going to be a marriage arrangement, there is going to be a land transaction of a large amount, like there's something major happening. But once again, this guy has zero clue of what's going on. Zero clue. 10 elders were brought over. Marriage, agreement, land purchasing, all this stuff's going through this guy's mind. And even today, we still have this kind of system, even to this day. But it's just modernized. For us, email is a huge witness tool. I email everybody, especially at work. Why? Number one, I hate talking on the phone. We'll get into that later. But number two, I can go back and read what you read, you said. You can go back and read what I said. So that when something comes up and he goes, no, I didn't say that, I can go back through the email and say yay or nay to that. The BCC, the Blind Carbon Coffee, I love that functioning email as well. I send a lot of stuff around, and I BCC a few people in it that don't even need to reply. It's just more or less, just keep this on hand just in case, because we don't know where anything's going. Love emailing as a witness. With 10 witnesses, the modern version for us today would be lawyers. Lawyers would be for our covenants, for our huge agreements that we have. Each time we have members join the church, together, we covenant together with one another to walk according to what God has laid out and to keep each other accountable. We are both making the covenant and being witnesses, and there are way more than 10 people here. Lawyers are required for the buying and selling of houses and property. So the principle of witnesses has been around for literally thousands of years, okay? So even when it comes to church discipline, if we flipped over to Matthew chapter 8, verses 15 and 17, we won't flip there today, but we see here that a member of church, when he's confronted about sin and refuses to listen, the individual is to take, what? 2 or 3 witnesses. 2 or 3 witnesses. Why? Why are they to take 2 or 3 witnesses? It's so the matter can be established and the charges either approved or disapproved. And if it does not work, then it goes to the church, the other members of the body. Why? It's also so because the matter can be established by all and the members can be praying for the restoration and the repentance of the individual involved. Witnesses are key and have been key in biblical standards for years, thousands and thousands of years. Now, this closer relative to Naomi sits down, okay? He doesn't ask questions or nothing's recorded, comes over, sits down, and notice his name. No name is given. The dude's a John Doe, okay? I can't even call him John because we have several Johns that we know of. Guy actually lacks information. We don't have the information about his name. All we know of this guy is that he's a closer redeemer than Boaz, the closest relative to Naomi. And hence, he is the closest relative to Elimelech. Yet, he is still unnamed. Now, we may want to know his name, but we don't need to know his name. Many times in scriptures, when we read, we may think to ourselves or discuss with another, wouldn't it have been nice to have known such and such a detail? Wouldn't it have been nice to know this, to know that? How did the fleas stay on the ark? Why were mosquitoes kept alive? Like, there's so many questions that we just don't have answers to, that we just trust in the goodness and sovereignty of God. But there's always some kind of speculation as to why this detail's been left out or what the detail is. But truth be told, it's only speculation. Why do we not know those details? Why are we not given this man's name? Well, because knowing or not knowing actually has zero effect on this entire text. Has zero effect on this entire story. Not knowing this Redeemer's name has absolutely no bearing on which way this story is going to flow. And God knows which information we need to know and what information we don't need to know. Just imagine for 1 minute, please. Imagine for 1 minute if God had put in every single detail regarding his people, the chosen people of Israel. The volumes of books would be unimaginable. Years, as we read through the Old Testament, are literally skipped, generations skipped in single verses. with no mention of what happens in between. There would be so much information. We would be so overwhelmed with the information, we would actually never see the point of the story. So when we come upon details that we would like to know but are not given, do not be discouraged, but rather praise God for not giving us every detail so that we can know the pertinent details about his son, Jesus, and seeing that story through the scriptures. That was a side note for you all. So, this unnamed man, whom Boaz knows, but he doesn't call him by name as recorded, sits down with Boaz and the 10 elders. He knows something's major legal transaction is going to transpire. He doesn't know what it is, but he knows something major. And just remember, this guy has no idea what's going to take place. I cannot emphasize this enough. This guy is literally going to be walking out of the gate. He's thinking about building the new barn, the crops that are coming in, the blah, 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 blah. Hey, come here and sit down. Okay, oh my goodness, what's going on right now? This is where we're at. And I love this part about Boaz, because he did not beat around the bush. He did not say, oh, how's it going? Da, 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 da. No, he cuts right to the chase. Boaz cuts right to the chase. Verses 3 to 6, we see this. If you know me, you know I do not generally like talking on the phone. I like cutting to the chase, so to speak. Let's say what needs to be said, get off the telephone. Okay? I used to talk for hours with Lynette. Even today, Lynette and I still talk a lot. But there's times it comes a dull, and I'm like, all right, let's hang up the phone. I'm done. Like, I don't know what else needs to be said. It's just the difference between her and I. It's great. Because if she talked like me, we would never talk, and then there'd be no marriage, and then we'd have a whole other issue on our hands. I like keeping it short. Boaz here keeps it short. Let's say what needs to be said and have it said. That is what Boaz is doing with this Redeemer. Boaz, as recorded, did not beat around the bush. Boaz does not ask how this guy is doing, as we see recorded here. He literally jumps in and says, paraphrasing, Naomi's selling the land. I want to buy it. I can't because of you. So are you going to buy it or not? That's the condensed version. Naomi's selling the land. You get first dibs on it. I don't. Now, Boaz could have done something sneaky here. He could have gone out, and this is even notes, so this is a bonus for you guys today. He could have gone out and bought the land, done the transactions, and probably had to pay like a penalty price to this unnamed guy, but he doesn't. He's above board with this whole thing, and he's got the 10 witnesses as well, okay? So he says above board with this whole thing. And I also want to mention right now, I want you to scour the chapters of Ruth. Where did Naomi ever say she wanted to sell the land? I can't find one instance of her coming up and saying, Boaz, I want to sell the land. Or her going out to the market saying, hey, I got land to sell. I can't take care of it. It needs to be done and taken care of. But I want you to know, Boaz is not lying either. Boaz is not being deceptive. Boaz is not being tricky. Boaz is not saying, I got an inside scoop and you need to know about it. Naomi got Ruth to go and lay at Boaz's feet when he was asleep. Naomi had Ruth proclaim her willingness to be his wife. Naomi patiently had this planned for some time in order for Boaz to be the kinsman redeemer. And if he was the kinsman redeemer to Ruth, he had to purchase the land. When Boaz promised Ruth the matter would be settled that day, Boaz knew it would potentially cost him financially, and this would have been part of the deal. He was not going to get Ruth as a wife, but also all of the debts associated with her and Naomi as well. Marrying her was going to come with a financial cost, a financial burden. He knows this, and that's why he can legitimately say, Naomi is wanting to sell the land. Now, this Redeemer, among the witnesses, hears this, okay? He only knows about the land. He only hears this. I can get good land for cheap and add it to my own possessions. Whew, what a good business deal. This guy probably thought, lucky day! Lucky day! This is not a first-come, first-served basis. This guy has the right to buy it before Boaz. So like any good businessman, he jumps at the opportunity to purchase this land. This good investment, this adding to his fortune, adding to his estate. Yet Boaz pulls a Columbo. Yes, I was hoping for a few chuckles because you know what I'm talking about. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you need to watch Columbo.
Now, let's see. Here's one more thing that's bugging me.
Boaz pulls the Columbo here. Just one more thing. After this guy said, yes, I want to buy the land, he says, oh, just hold on. I never gave you all the details. Just one more thing. Just one more thing. I love his tactic here. I love it. This Redeemer is among the witnesses. He says, I want to buy this land. Boaz pulls his Columbo. There are 10 people that are sworn witnesses that are seeing this all take place and are not saying a thing. This guy's like, yes, I want to buy it. Just hold on, one more thing. What's this one more thing? Which goes to show, this guy has no clue and has not been thinking about Ruth and Naomi at all. Boaz has purposely omitted this piece of information, and apparently this Redeemer has not been thinking about this at all. Boaz pulls out the initial additional information, and boom, this guy's taken off guard. Woo! He's off balance, off guard. Boaz got him exactly where he wants him. This Redeemer has to make a decision now. He is off kilter. He's off guard. He does not say, he cannot say, let me go home and think about it. He has to make his decision now, today, in this moment. This is a wise business tactic by Boaz's part. Because he wants Ruth as a wife. He wants to redeem the land. He wants to be that kinsman redeemer. So he doesn't put all his cards on the table. He puts the cards on necessary and then drops the final trump card here. This Redeemer must now make his decision. And his decision was quick. His decision is that he relinquishes his right to Boaz. The really reason he relinquishes his right to Boaz is given, lest I impair my own inheritance. So a lot of commentators speculate, and once again, this is speculation, that this guy either wasn't as wealthy as Boaz, or he had children with his probably current wife. Which means if he took Ruth to perpetuate the name of Elimelech, his wealth is now split between his children and the children he would have with Ruth to perpetuate the name. It could also be the financial burden. It was also speculated Ruth of the Moabite, he may not have wanted that family connection. For whatever reason, this guy says, I can't, lest I impair my own inheritance. I can't do it, Boaz. I won't do it, Boaz. This guy literally wants the land, but none of the burdens associated with it. That is Ruth. Ruth to this guy is a burden and a liability. Done. Boaz's plan has worked. And the only one nearer to Elimelech has now refused to redeem the land and to redeem Ruth in the front of 10 witnesses. Now, you may all be asking like I was, what in the world is this losing the shoe bit? Guy takes off his sandal, passes it over. They assume it's Boaz, don't know. I'm going to be completely honest. Let's think about this logically. This is the physical testimony to everyone that says this guy, this one-sandaled guy, just made a business deal and relinquished his right to something. I tell you, I wouldn't forget that day. If I was one of the 10 witnesses seeing the guy take off his sandal and have to walk away one shoe, Boaz wouldn't forget that day. And you have to ask the question, did he keep it as a spare or as a souvenir? It was a physical reminder, a physical attestation to everyone there he relinquished his rights. That he gave up his right. Here, physical reminder. Done. Wow. Boaz's plan, guy running on no sleep, worked flawlessly. So verses 9 to 12, we see the blessing of the people here. The blessing of the people. So we have Boaz's plan put in action. We have now the blessing of the people. Now Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "You are witnesses this day that have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon, his kids. I have bought to be my wife to perpetuate the name of the dead in the inheritance, and that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day." Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. You may act worthily in Ephrath and be known in Bethlehem, be renowned in Bethlehem. May your house be like the house of Perez and whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman." The blessing of the people. So Boaz recaps everything that just happened. We don't need to go through that again. He just recapped it all. I believe he just wants to be extra clear. This is where things are at. This is where we stand. End of story. Very clear. Very concise. 10 witnesses know he's a redeemer. He understands what that's entailing. He quickly said, "I'm taking Ruth. I'm perpetuating the name. I'm buying all the land. This is how it is." So there's no question marks whatsoever. "I'm buying all the land of Ruth from Naomi, from Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. And Mahlon's wife, his widow Ruth, is going to be my wife." There's zero room for error. There's no way of being misunderstood. Boaz was clear and concise. And I honestly want to say, how many times could issues be avoided if we were just more clear and more concise? I have given lists to my kids before. I like lists. I like details, and I overburden them with details at times. So when they go and do these lists that I give them, half the stuff isn't done or isn't done right. Why? Because I overburden them with details. I wasn't clear and concise. Sometimes it's because they just forget, okay? But being clear and concise, need to have their attention. I don't give them a lot of details for the work. I just want to be clear and concise. But it's not just kids. It's also adults as well. When I'm at work and I'm telling people what to do, I try and be very clear and very concise. Because I've learned the more detail I give, the more things get messed up. I'll even draw out. I want this pipe to go from here to here. Just here to here. Get it through there. Do it. Done. And this is the size pipe I want. Something very simple. Just as another example, let's look at the LBC, the London Baptist Confession of Faith, the 1689 LBC of the faith. It's long. Yet, within this very long and very needed long document are very clear and concise statements of faith. We're actually going slowly through them with the kids, one statement at a time. And there are literally some statements that the kids say, "Wow, that was pretty straightforward." Wow, that was pretty straightforward. Why? Because the statement was clear and concise. The statement was able to be understood both by children and by adults. God is good to have had people in the past write such statements that can be read and even for us to digest them, even to this day. Let's move on. The witnesses proclaim a standard, yet a very prophetic blessing. We're going to just break it down quickly here. First, they say, "May the Lord." First and foremost, we may stop and pause to consider this phrase, "May the Lord," "May Yahweh." This is not something that people are commanding for God to do, but rather they are being hopeful that He and His sovereignty would do. Thus, the outcome is dependent on the Lord, on Yahweh, and on Yahweh alone. It is not up to man to make things happen and work, but up to God. God uses people, but the ultimate weight lies on the Almighty One, the only one that can shoulder the weight. Also, if the outcome was not desirable, then God is still to be praised. Many times people say, "If the Lord wills, I will do thus and thus." And when it doesn't come about, they either get sad or they get upset or they get angry. Other people say, "I guess that wasn't the Lord's will," which is a proper response. Why? Because we need to adjust our plans and go with God's plans. And sometimes we need to completely scrap our plans. As you know, last week, that is very hard to do. Like Rachel and Leah. They want Ruth to be like Rachel and Leah. Now, anyone who's been in church long enough knows who Rachel and Leah are. They are Jacob's two wives. These two women, along with their servants, were the ones who bore the children that are now known as the 12 tribes of Israel. Most people would want to hear this blessing, but would never think it being obtainable. What a high honor to be known as the founding father of Israel. What a blessing to have such a high renown, to be so fruitful and multiply as Rachel and Leah, to have such renowned children as them. The house would have been so blessed, it would shine all in the country. And then they continue on and say, "May you act worthily." Now, this further blessing is focused towards Boaz, to continue to be worthy, to continue to be an upright man that he is, and furthermore, that his household will continue to be more and more and more and more prosperous. But why do the elders reference Perez? What? What's this Perez we're talking about? Perez is seen in Genesis chapter 46 and verse 12. We see that he's a son of Judah. Perez had two sons, Hebron and Hamul. And when we go over to Numbers chapter 26, verses 20 and 22, we see Perez and his two sons mentioned again, but with further detail. And the sons of Perez were of Hezron, the clan of the Hezronites, and of Hamul, the clan of the Hamulites. Now we see that Perez's two sons became so renowned and fruitful that they became their own clans. Essentially, the elders are now praying that God would bless Boaz so much that his lineage would carry on throughout the ages. And once again, most people would hear this and think, "Yeah, if I only got a portion of this, that would be awesome." Matthew Henry says this about this particular verse. They prayed for Boaz that he might continue to do worthily in the city to which he was an ornament, and might there be more and more famous. They desired that the wife, Ruth, might be a blessing in the private affairs of the house, and the husband a blessing in the public business of the town. That she in her place and he in his might be wise, virtuous, and successful. Before we move on to think of the honor these elders prayed to the Lord on Boaz's behalf, there was a huge honor, and this was a huge honor to have done for you. This godly, upright man has been exhorted to stay in the path that he has been going, and furthermore, that God would bless him beyond his wildest dreams. Just because someone is moving in the right direction in life does not mean they do not need encouragement or exhortation to continue in that way. There was a saying at NBBI that at one point was even etched into their gym floor, and it was, "Finish well." Now, as a 20-something kid, I thought finishing well was the easy part. You actually get momentum going, like a large container ship, and you just kind of keep just cruising along. Finish well. But over the years of seeing people in high position fall into grievous sins, and even today still struggling with sin, those words mean more and more to me each day. Finish well. Boaz, finish well. Boaz, you've lived and have been living a morally upright life. Don't stop. We can never stop fighting the battle of sin, never stop striving towards more Christ-likeness, and never stop encouraging one another to finish well. Now, in the last part of this text, in verses 13 to 22, we see the blessing of Yahweh. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception. She bore a son. Then the woman said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without redeemer. And may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age, for your daughter-in-law, who loves you, is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him." Then Naomi took the child, laid it on her lap, and became his nurse. Relish in that for a minute. And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." They named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now these are the generations of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Amminadab. And Amminadab fathered Nahshon. Nahshon fathered Solomon. Solomon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse. And Jesse fathered David. From great grief to great joy. When Naomi lost everything, she looked at her daughters-in-laws and told them, quite frankly, she was without hope of any kind. When Naomi returned home and exclaimed all that was there, she told them to call her Mara because of the grief of her soul. She did not even think that she would ever have joy or hope once again. Ruth and Boaz now are married. And even more, Ruth has borne a son to Elimelech. Her husband's lineage would continue. Her own son's lineage would continue. And now the women who first said, "Is this Naomi?" are now rejoicing with her, calling her blessed. God never left Naomi alone. Even though her husband tried to hide his family from God's judgment, God was faithful to Naomi. Even when Naomi lost everything she had, God was still faithful to her. When she returned home, poverty stricken with no joy, God was still with Naomi. And now, the women proclaim, "Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a redeemer." Naomi needed redemption. Naomi had no other hope that she would ever climb up from where she'd fallen. She needed a redeemer, and Boaz, through God's divine providence, gave Naomi a redeemer. Boaz redeemed the land that Naomi owned, which she could not have managed. Boaz gave a perpetuation to her husband's name, which she had lost. Boaz lavished Naomi with wealth from which she had none. Yes, Boaz was the redeemer. Boaz reached down to the depths, soiled his hands, dirtied his clothes, and brought Naomi up to peace and prosperity once again. So Ruth has borne a son to Boaz. Naomi has life in her arms once again from when there was only death. Ruth has been kind and so faithful to Naomi that in this end has brought a much greater kindness to her. God used a non-Jew, a Moabite woman, an outcast of Jewish society, to bring about redemption for Naomi, a son to continue a family lineage. Now, I want us to notice here that when they talk about Obed, who fathered David, generations may be skipped. I actually remember reading this several times going, I wonder how much Boaz knew of David. Did he visit him often? He would have been an old guy at that point. Matthew chapter 3, verse 9, Jesus talking to the Pharisees says, "Do not presume to say to yourselves that we have Abraham as our father, for I tell you, God is able from these stones to raise up children from Abraham." Generations may be skipped. How many generations between those people and Abraham at that time of Jesus' day? Many generations, yet they still called him father. John Gill says this about the generational gap. Jesse is thought to be, and this is in context of Matthew chapter 1 he's talking right now. Jesse is thought to be not the immediate son of Obed, but to be about the fourth generation from him. Though no others are mentioned between them in Ruth or them here being in Matthew chapter 1. So verses 18 to 22 show how David is only mentioned in the house of David is in the house of Jesse as well. Yet David was the youngest of the brothers, the runt, the sheep herder, the bear killer, the lion slayer, and ultimately the first one to become Jack the Giant Slayer, taking down a man of ginormous size and becoming king. His brothers here are not even mentioned. Lineage of a king. For 2 minutes, please turn over to Matthew chapter 1. For this is something that if we do not see, we miss the entirety of the reason of the book of Ruth. Matthew chapter 1. For time's sake, I'm only going to start reading the first 5 verses. And then verse 16. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, and Judah the father of Perez, there he is again, and Zerah by Tamar. Perez the father of Hezron, and Hezron the father of Ram, and Ram the father of Amminadab, and Amminadab the father of Nahshon, and Nahshon the father of Solomon, Solomon the father of Boaz by Rahab, and Boaz, the father of Obed by Ruth, and Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of David of the kings. In verse 16, and Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born, who is called the Christ. Now, the first 5 verses there, I want to pick out 3 names there that should stand out to you. Tamar, Rahab, Ruth. 3 women mentioned. Tamar had been married twice. Each one died. Youngest brother, you can see this all in Genesis chapter 38. Youngest brother comes of age. She doesn't get married to him. She deceives her father-in-law. Not a really good reputation. Rahab, seen in Joshua chapter 2 and Joshua chapter 6, is a harlot. A harlot in Jericho, and she and all in her household were the only ones to survive the fall of Jericho. Ruth. We just finished learning about Ruth, but let's just do a quick recap. She's a Moabite woman who had no inheritance in Israel. This child that was born, Ruth, being a child that was born to idol worshippers and was an idol worshipper by chance. Married an Israelite, went to a country that was foreign to her with her mother-in-law. Now, we can take time and go through each and every individual through there and see how they all had faults of some kind. But down in verse 16, it says, "And Jesus was born who was a Christ." What's the point of all of this? Here's the point. 3 men, women, only 3 people we've looked at, all of which had very questionable pasts. All these women have done not one thing to be a part of the lineage of the Messiah, the God-man, the tabernacle that dwelled among the people. Yet why are they even mentioned? Why did God in his sovereignty use them in the lineage of Jesus? Because God's plans are not contingent on you and I. God did not require a perfect, fault-free lineage. And if we were to look at all the names in death, we would know and we would see and we could point out sin after sin after sin and all the faults within these people. To God, sin is sin. He was using sinful people to fulfill his work, to fulfill his plan and his promises to bring about the one that would crush the head of the serpent. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 18 to 31, it talks about God using foolishness to confound the wise. He used weak things to shame the strong. And I love in verse 26 how he says, "For consider your calling, brothers. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. And not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth." Today I extol you, and today I challenge you, and I also plead with you. If you've not accepted this foolishness of God that confounds the wise, if you are resisting this weakness of God that shames the strong, I implore you to turn and repent. Turn in the manner that Ruth turned to Boaz. Weak, empty-handed, knowing you have nothing to offer, but he has everything to give to you. Cry out to God for forgiveness. Forgiveness not based on your own broken, sin-filled, corrupted lineage life, but on the work of Jesus and Jesus alone, who is called the Christ. Also for us who are in Christ, I exhort myself at the same time to act as Boaz has acted, morally upright, fulfilling the law to the ability that God has granted you and I. Boaz was not perfect, but he trusted in the perfect one. Boaz was not sinless, but he looked towards the sinless one. Boaz was not rich beyond his wildest dreams, but he rested in the one who owns all things and upholds all things by the word of his power. We too must act like Boaz. We too are to live in this way, looking towards God, looking towards who he is, not who we are. Trusting in him and his ability, not in us and our own abilities. Ruth and Boaz would never have thought in their wildest dreams they would have been in the lineage, not of just a king, but the King of Kings. Their obedience to God, God used to further his plan and his glory. So be obedient. So God uses your obedience to further his plan and his glory. Amen and amen.